This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Stay tuned for the Butte Report. Welcome to the Butte Report. Today is Thursday, March 4th, 2021. The Butte Report is a weekly program reporting on and analyzing issues that affect our lives and our livelihood by focusing on local government, including the Board of Supervisors, the various municipalities, and even school districts and water districts within Butte County. I'm your host, Sue Hildebrand. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Dr. Mac, your traveling Apple products expert. Dr. Mac trains you to maximize all your Apple products, assisting you with setup, data transfer, troubleshooting, and repairs, including critical updates and malware removal. Kevin Mallory is Dr. Mac, the technical doctor who still makes house calls, and he also does remote assistance. You can find Dr. Mac on Facebook at Dr. Mac Help or at 530-386-2616. Tonight on the Butte Report, we'll cover the Oroville City Council, the Chico City Council, and more. We'll also talk about the upcoming Brown Bag Lunch discussion series sponsored by the Butte County Water Department. On Tuesday, the Oroville City Council met with Chuck Reynolds out of quarantine after testing positive for COVID on February 14th. Although there was clear plexiglass between the council members, the mayor and most of the city council still declined to wear masks. The main issue of the meeting was the discussion about who would provide fire services for the city. About 40 protesters could be heard outside of council chambers, calling for the council to continue its relationship with the locally controlled Oroville Fire Department and not to outsource to the state CAL FIRE. The Oroville Fire Department is the second oldest fire company in the state and has provided fire services to the area even before Oroville was incorporated. The main argument presented by Mayor Reynolds and City Administrator Bill Legrone for moving to CAL FIRE was the cost to the city for paying for the California Public Employees Retirement System on behalf of the Oroville firefighters. If the city received fire services from CAL FIRE, part of the contract would include the requirement of the state hiring the Oroville firefighters, and then CAL FIRE would pay into that retirement system. After much discussion, Councilmember David Pittman made a motion to direct the city administrator to return with some proposals or agencies that might help councilors put the city growth plan together to include fire and police and to include areas outside of the city limits such as Thermalito, South Oroville, and East Oroville. That motion passed 4-3. Councilmember Chrissy Riggs then motioned to authorize staff to issue a letter of intent for full protection services to CAL FIRE and to begin negotiations. This motion also passed 4-3. Councilmember Janet Goodson was one of the three members who voted against the letter of intent to replace Oroville Fire with CAL FIRE. I spoke with her about her vote and started by asking her to talk about her concerns about replacing Oroville Fire with CAL FIRE.
My concern is the motivation behind the request for proposal to outsource our fire protection services to CAL FIRE by the majority of the council members and by our city administrator, Bill Legrone. When I hear that CalPERS unfunded liabilities is the reason, then I have to research how much, if any, went outsourcing to CAL FIRE saved the city. And from the information that I have gathered, CAL FIRE comes at a much greater cost. The simple fact that the salaries for each position are higher. The city of Oroville will have no control over contractual salary increases by CAL FIRE. And there is no guarantee that our firefighters will remain in the Oroville area. The fact that with Oroville expanding, there is a push to annex the Thermalito area, which extends out towards the Oroville airport. Approximately 6,000 people live in that area. CAL FIRE will be looking for Oroville to provide a fire station in that area. when equipment fails, a fire engine is no longer operational, it will be the responsibility of Oroville to purchase, replace, and cover any equipment repair costs. And as I had mentioned earlier, they will want the city of Oroville to provide a fire station in that area as well. When there is a fire in the outlying areas where the response time will take longer than 5 minutes and a plane carrying fire retardant has to be used, who covers that expense? Oroville has to cover that expense. And these are just a few examples of how outsourcing to CAL FIRE will cost the city of Oroville. And in regards to CalPERS, CalPERS will never, ever go away. We will always have unfunded liabilities.
Councilmember Goodson, you mentioned at the meeting the other day that based on the budget numbers of the city, you see a city that is financially stable, and that you even talked about voters who supported the 1 cent sales tax, Measure U. They did not vote for it so that the city could outsource its fire services. The entire argument for contracting with the state is that it will save the city money, but you sound very skeptical of that argument.
To date, I have talked to many constituents, and I have found that not one community resident, not one registered voter who voted for Measure U thought that the money from the 1% sales tax revenue was going to go towards contracting the city's fire and protection services out to CAL FIRE. Up until 2018, when Measure U was put on the ballot, the city had been operating in the red for a number of years, holding steady at a deficit of $1.8 million. The city council, we had to freeze jobs, there was a hiring freeze, and the city was working at a skeletal staff. Oroville Police and Oroville Fire were both significantly understaffed. And as you know, the primary job of the city and the city council members is to ensure the safety of its citizens and visitors. So what happened is OPD and OFD, there were council members, there were concerned citizens. We had boots on the ground. We knocked on doors. We handed out flyers, pleading with the citizens to vote for the 1% sales tax increase. Otherwise, we were on the verge of declaring bankruptcy. The people were told that the monies would solely be used for fortifying our public safety and firefighter staff and equipment in order to operate expeditiously and to keep our citizens, our businesses, and our neighborhoods safe. The people asked for a citizens' oversight committee to oversee and ensure that the monies were going to be used for the measure's intended purpose. To date, that committee has not met since last February. The committee is now scheduled to meet on March 9th, but only at the insistence of a committee member who is so outraged that the monies would be going to an outside fire protection entity, that being CAL FIRE.
Congressmember Goodson, at the meeting the other day, in a vote of 4-3, the council issued a letter, or the council directed staff to issue a letter of intent to CAL FIRE moving forward in exploring this partnership. Tell us, what are the next steps before a final decision is made?
According to the vote, prior to council member Riggs making an amendment to include the letter of intent to CAL FIRE, the motion was made by Councilman David Pittman that would give direction to the city administrator to research consulting firms that could assist the council with putting a growth plan together with community input, not just within the confines of our city limits right now, but also community input from the residents in Thermalito as well, since this would be the next potential area of expansion. True, COVID has played a huge part in the public not being able to interact with the council during open session, but as we all know, we've gotten accustomed to using a virtual platform. That's not foreign to us. Council Member Riggs asked that a letter of intent to CAL FIRE be sent in conjunction with the growth plan that would engage community input and feedback. What concerns me is that the motion was done in such haste after the break, where the motion by Councilman Pittman had been motioned, it had been seconded by me. Then there was a 15-minute break. After the break, the amendment was made. Now, what concerns me is that the motion requesting that a letter of intent to be sent to CAL FIRE, there was no specificity. LOIs can have binding and or non-binding clauses written into that contractual obligation. So it will be interesting to see how that letter is going to be drafted by the city attorney.
That was Oroville City Council member Janet Goodson. You are listening to the Butte Report on KZFR 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Chico. The Chico City Council also met this week after missing last meeting because of potential exposure to COVID of a few of its members. In a 5-2 vote, the council officially fired the city attorney, Andrew Jared, and rehired attorney Vince Ewing. Ewing was the acting attorney when the Chico City Council sued the citizen organization Move the Junkyard after the organization gathered enough signatures to overturn a city council-passed ordinance. And finally, a move that many believe is politically motivated, Councilmember Cammie Denley requested a discussion about converting the informal Greater Chico Homeless Task Force to a formal city commission. The task force is a collaborative community group that includes service providers, city staff, and the general public. It has been in existence for 25 years, and many community organizations in Chico today grew out of the task force, including the Torres Shelter and the Chico Housing Action Team. The city's only support for this group is to supply meeting announcements. It offers no money and no staff time. One concern by city staff is that converting the task force into a formal city commission would cost the city money in required staff roles and responsibilities to meet Brown Act requirements. Denley's main argument for converting the group to a city commission was that the group lacked transparency, citing the fact that she was asked to not share the Zoom credentials with anyone who was not a member of the task force. However, when asked about Denley's example, the executive team chair of the Greater Chico Homeless Task Force, Angela McLaughlin, explained that this rule was put into place after an early cyber attack during a Zoom call. One of the main criticisms of Denley and why many believe her efforts are politically motivated is that she was appointed to represent the city council on the task force, but she had not attended any of the meetings when she called for a review of its work. Denley made a motion to direct staff to research the process of converting the task force to a commission, and Scott Huber offered a substitute motion that would have the city sever all ties to the task force, allowing the task force to continue its work without the city's interference. Alex Brown seconded the motion, but the motion was defeated for reasons that seemed unclear to most observers, once again suggesting a political motive. Denley's motion eventually passed by a vote of 4-2, with Topeka Tandon abstaining from the vote, again for reasons that were unclear. Before the Chico City Council meeting even started, a group of about 40 gathered at the steps of City Hall for speeches and a protest in the form of a die-in. KZFR's Bill Mash was on the ground and filed this report.
Guillermo Mash reporting on the demonstration protesting the ongoing houseless encampment sweeps held in the hour prior to the start of the 6 p.m. March 2nd Chico City Council session. During the hour outside the chambers, I observed a well-organized and peaceful demonstration of 40 to 50 people, ranging in age from 7 to 77, not including approximately 8 Chico police officers who arrived on scene around 5:30 p.m. making one arrest for obstructing slash resisting a peace officer. The demonstrators were protesting the ongoing sweeps of houseless community members in an action named Protest for Humanity, which included a die-in where approximately a dozen protesters laid on their backs with placards and signs with the names of community members who have died on the street. I chose two interviews for our listeners tonight, starting with Harry Helsteed, a member of the houseless community directly affected by the sweeps and Alicia, who was present with her husband and 7-year-old son, Juno. This is Larry D. Halstead, member of the press, and he's going to kind of explain his story about being houseless here in Chico and advocating for folks like him. Thanks for being on KZFR, Larry.
Let me just say briefly that as a campfire survivor, someone with stage 4 cancer, 68 years old, I've exhausted all remedies for housing assistance. The actions of the city council and the PD are cruel, inhumane. They're illegal. They fly in the face of every moral code that any religion offers. And we have to end it. I have now received the first citation pushing back on the notion that this is all voluntary compliance with these sweeps. And it's time now to take it to the courts.
What location was that at? Boucher?
Yeah, I got the citation at Boucher, but I had already been evicted from up by Cape Breakers.
Now, were you literally sleeping there when the whole sweep came through? Is that where you've been kind of finding a place to shelter at post campfire without a place up on the ridge?
Yeah, I was up there next to the campfire council pit since May the 2nd. We did move once when they said you had to move 50 feet away from the water. And we did that on July 17. So from July 17 until 2 weeks ago, I was there at Cape Breakers.
Some of the thing that really got under my craw, Larry, is this whole, you know, a lot of these people that were positioning this framing really don't spend time in the park, but this whole houseless people, homeless people have destroyed our park and they're tearing it apart. I mean, maybe you could add some clarity on what you experienced at the fire pit and, you know, what kind of campsites you had around you.
Yeah, definitely. They are pushing a false narrative that the homeless are all the same. They all use needles. They dump their needles all over the place. They're all, you know, taking, I guess, in the creek or whatever. I mean, Action News Now over there, they had a piece they ran. This was way back, I don't know, August or earlier. They had a biologist down there at the river showing it and saying that, no, people are not increasing the pollution of it. And if they were, they're not doing it any more than everybody swimming in Sycamore Pond all year. But the drug abuse and the substance abuse, that's not unique for homelessness. That issue precedes our current homeless crisis. We're not addressing the homeless issue. We're not addressing the drug issue. We're not addressing any substance abuse. We have the biggest bloated police department budget going, and they just increased it just so that they can increase their war on terrorism. So, no, I don't buy any of the stuff that they're trying to paint at it. And, you know, it's fine and good to demonize the homeless, but you have to also push back and say, well, wait a minute. Do they have any other alternative? Is there something else for them? Not just in terms of camping, but ability to feed themselves and to take care of themselves and house themselves.
What do you mean? You made a quote I've never heard from this side. It was like, it's fine and good to demonize the homeless. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean that's what they always do. And we have to go beyond that and say, hey, you know, you can just sit there and demonize people all you want with all these broad generalizations and whatever. But no, that's not addressing the issue. You know, they're dancing around the issue.
All right, Larry, any closing comments?
No, except that it's time to take it to the courts. I'm personally prepared to do that. I'm going to be seeking a preliminary injunction. And as soon as we get that filed, we're able to go directly to the Ninth Circuit Court where the Martin v. Boise case is the ruling.
All the best wishes with that, and all the best wishes for your health.
Thank you. Great talking to you. Appreciate you being out here.
Yeah, I'm out here with a beautiful family. I'd say you're about 8.
Seven.
Oh, Juno, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. So what can you say about your sign, ma'am? Help our unhoused neighbors.
Yeah, well, that's why we're out here. We don't see the city council doing anything to help except sending out police, evicting people, not giving them a safe space to go. And that's what we want to see for our unhoused neighbors here in Chico.
What do you expect this small demonstration? They say small. There's a good turnout. There's like 20, 24, 30 people. What are you expecting from it?
I'm hoping to see some action. I'm hoping to see the city council finally take this issue up and discuss it and stop ignoring it and stop leaving it up to law enforcement to illegally evict people with nowhere else to go. So I'm hoping that they will also find safe space, safe shelter for our unhoused neighbors.
9 years of doing this and knowing people that have been doing it for 40, it seems like, you know, electeds and, you know, officials are really comfortable talking about it, as long as they don't have to do anything that's above and beyond sweeping people. Any comments on that?
Just that I agree. I've seen the same thing with my last 12 years in Chico, and I'm fed up with it.
You are listening to the Butte Report on KZFR 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Chico. Last weekend, in a letter written to the Chico City Council and city staff, San Francisco attorney Rob Berry lamented the assistance by private citizens given to unhoused people while their encampments were being removed by the police and public works departments. Berry included his intentions to, quote, engage in and encourage the exercise of citizen arrest rights against any parties observed to violate city ordinances. He went on to state that he expects the police to investigate those citizen arrests. The letter was also hand-delivered to the chair of the executive team of the Greater Chico Homeless Task Force, Angela McLaughlin. Interpreted as a personal threat, McLaughlin wrote to the city manager, Mark Orme, calling on the city to publicly rebuke Berry's vigilantism. In response to these letters, the Chico Police Department issued a press release clarifying the process of a citizen's arrest and stated, quote, if a peace officer determines the citizen has not provided the proper evidence to support an arrest, the police officer will decline the arrest. The citizen making the arrest takes on the civil liability of making potential false arrests and could be held criminally responsible for rights violations such as the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Butte County District Attorney Mike Ramsey has also suggested that law enforcement should be left in the hands of law enforcement officers. Last night, the Chico Unified School District Board of Trustees voted unanimously to approve $8.2 million to help address social distancing needs, staffing, and counseling in preparation for a potential full in-person reopening of the district in the fall. As reported by the Enterprise Record, the funds consist of a one-time money that is provided through the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. And finally, next week, the Butte County Department of Water and Resource Conservation will kick off its Brown Bag Seminar series. This series will offer the public an opportunity to learn more about the technical aspects of implementing the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, which requires all communities to monitor and sustainably manage its groundwater. The series will also offer an opportunity for community dialogue as it relates to water use and conservation. The first workshop is scheduled for Wednesday, March 10th, beginning at noon on Zoom, called Perspectives on Butte County Land Use Changes. One of the presentations will offer an analysis of agricultural land use changes in Butte County, the Sacramento Valley, and the San Juan Keene Valley using the Crop Report. The presenter is Butte County Water Commissioner Amy Raymond, who I spoke with yesterday and started by asking her to talk about the purpose of the workshop and how it relates to SGMA.
The purpose of the Brown Bag, you know, seminars, they are being hosted by the Butte County Water Department. And their goal is to give us an opportunity to present data and have meaty conversation. I sit on the Water Commission, and these commissions and committees and stuff that are under the Brown Act have a very regulated format that they need to go to hold. And so it's very difficult to have frank dialogue and conversation with folks. So the Butte County Water Department thought that it would be great to take some of these, you know, meaty topics and put the information out and start a dialogue and a discord for it. And so one of the topics that I had brought up at Water Commission that I wanted to talk about was an analysis that I had recently done utilizing the USDA's database, which records the number of harvested acres on a yearly basis by crop. And the data also includes the value of the crop. And what had inspired me was that we had gone down, my husband and I had driven down to Los Angeles, and I was just struck with how many new orchards littered I-5 as we were driving. And I thought, my goodness, you know, we know that we have a water problem down there, yet they are planting all of these orchards. And I go, knowing in Butte County that we're seen as the source of water, so that just creates great demand for our water. And so I was curious about, you know, well, how has the number of harvested acres changed over time? So I pulled down the USDA data set. That data set goes back from 1980 to 2019. And is done every year by a repeatable process. The data is aggregated, it's reviewed, it's reported on, you know, and so it's curated. So I felt pretty comfortable that that was a good solid data set. And what I found in that analysis of looking at the counties in the San Joaquin Valley was that they had actually grown in the last 20 years 1 million acres. So they went from 1.7 million acres to 2.7 million acres. And this is in the last 20 years. I was just stunned by that number. In addition, with SGMA and groundwater sustainability, you know, we're now looking at our sub-basins and we're saying basically for Butte County and our sub-basin, you know, if it rains 5 inches on the surface area of Butte County, that's the volume of water, you know, all of our acres by that distance, that is the, you know, amount of water that our sub-basin gets to work with. And that system depends on how our groundwater works. It has Tehama County, which actually flows water into Butte County, and Glen County to the west of us on the Sacramento River, is that the water flows down our watershed, you know, to the Sacramento River, and actually the water models show it flowing in towards Glen County. So I thought, wow, it'd be interesting to know how Tehama County is doing in harvested acres and mixtures, as well as I'd be very interested, you know, what's Glen County doing and what are we doing in Butte County? What I found was in Butte County, we had actually reduced the number of harvested acres, but our crop mixture has changed. So we have moved, we have lost that acreage in what's called field and seed crops. So think, you know, that's beans and sunflowers and alfalfa and those sorts of crops. And we have actually gained acreage in fruit and nut trees and in the orchards. So we're actually net up acreage because we lost acreage by what this is called pasture range, which is unirrigated rangeland. And we lost a little bit in irrigated pasture, but net, we grew acres overall in fruit and nut trees on that. So our net water demand has actually gone up for Butte County, even though you're saying, hey, we are growing on fewer acres. So that was kind of the inspiration. So at this Brown Bag seminar, which is going to be on March 10th, I'll present that analysis, and then we will open up to have conversation and discord about, you know, what our findings were and maybe where else to go, what other things we might want to think about, what other analysis we might want to do.
That was Butte County Water Commissioner Amy Raymond. Looking forward to next week, the Butte County Board of Supervisors will meet on Tuesday beginning at 9 a.m. The Oroville Elementary School District and the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Agency meet on Wednesday. And again, the Water Commission's Brown Bag series begins on Wednesday at 12 o'clock, lasting till 1:30 on Zoom. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating their 100th anniversary of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue in Chico. For more information, see squaredealmattress.com. Stay tuned for Chico News and Review on the radio with Jason Cassidy.